sustainable, yes. Interactive, hyper-local.
We come up with this tension that we have to serve a community that is underserved online, but at the same time, we have to engage with that community. But the less engaged or the less networked that community is, the better for us, for the project, because it will be very useful for them. But at the same time, if we have no threats to pull, so we're in that point.
I mean, our main discussion so far has been about looking at the various cuts that are forthcoming. But as I sent an email last night, my main reservation with that is it's hard to keep it to a hyper-local focus. Even if we just look at Birmingham's a huge area. If we look at just the city centre or just like a certain community within Birmingham, you'll have to look at like why Quango A is being cut and where that's based, and that might take your focus away from it, and you end up with the domino effect. And
yeah, and people aren't, I guess, aren't so much interested in cuts as a concept as much as how the cuts impact their particular community.
Because I mean, Samuel came up with a really cool logo, which I can't show you because I've got no internet connection. I was saying, like, if we did follow that through, could use the name Slash Brum, a bit of a, and came up with a quite cool logo on that, and with the emphasis on the cuts and the recovery. Mm-hmm. The other side of it is it could be quite a bummer to just be doing, this is being cut, these people are screwed over, this person's out of a job.
Maybe we can start by sort of hearing your story and how you came up with Created in Birmingham, and how you saw the need for that, and maybe you can give us advice as we go and search for our own hyper-local blogs.
Okay, well, there's three I was going to talk about. First one's Created in Birmingham, second one's westmidlandsdance.com. And the other is the News Dash project that's very slowly and painfully being given birth to at the moment. So Created in Birmingham is an arts and culture website. It's coming up to its fourth birthday, I think, in December. I need to check that. I'm rubbish at remembering those. And what it does is it was actually set up by two other guys, Pete Ashton and Steph Lewandowski. Pete Ashton is PeteAshton.com, fairly easy to find. Steph, his website is Steph, STEF.io. He's moved down to London now, but he was did live up here, he was very active, all sorts of things. So the reason for that is, the reason that came about is that Pete and Steph were off on one of the Birmingham Flickr meets, which happened, it's the second Sunday of every month. There's a Birmingham group on Flickr, and they meet up regularly, and they'll go around places around the city centre, and they'll take photos and all the rest of it. And they were talking on one of those about how there doesn't seem... It's quite hard to find out what arts and cultural stuff is going on, especially the stuff that's just...
below the mainstream.
Below the mainstream, yeah. But they both knew there was loads of stuff. It was just really hard to find it. So... Pete had a background in self-publishing fanzines and comic books and things like that, and he jumped on blogging really early on and saw that as a way to go about talking about some of the things that were going on. Just have a website just mentions all the interesting stuff that's going on, and after a while he starts to build up an archive of all the interesting that's happening in the city. So... he started off, and it's quite funny if you go back to the first posts on that, the way that he experimented with that. Started off really long form interviews that used to take him hours to do. He'd go out and meet some interesting people. I think if you look in the interviews tab and then just go down to the category and then just scroll right back, they should be in there still. But he realised that was just taking his whole life up, and so just grew disillusioned with that, and so instead started doing sort of one sentence posts or just links to other stuff and just saying these people are doing an interesting thing with a link, and like that was it, and made the focus not about Creating in Birmingham as a website, but the idea was to just signpost and push people off towards all those other things.
So it's like the redistribution of information rather than content itself.
Yeah. The idea was that after a while, and that started picking up a bit and started getting a bit of traction. The great thing is that when you start linking to loads of other sites, people start noticing that you exist. And because all it was doing was promoting those other sites, everyone was very well disposed towards it. That carried on for a fair while in that kind of vein. It's still pretty much the same concept now, although the focus changed. For starters, it used to be the point of view of an outsider kind of looking in on the arts community. But as it's gone along and kind of gained in stature, it's the thing that I find slightly interesting at the moment is that we're as much part of the kind of arts culture establishment after 4 years as anyone. We're not really, can't claim to be outsiders anymore. I've worked with quite a lot of people we write about, or I'm friends with them, or I just know what they, there's a bit of a history of a relationship there. Creating in Birmingham started off, it was funded for the first 18 months or so. There's an organisation called Creative Republic that kind of a lobbying group that kind of comes and goes. They Steph managed to get a little bit of cash to fund it for a while, so it made it worthwhile carrying on continuing that.
I'll mention it to you later.
So so first 18 months got a bit of cash to kind of keep Pete paid and is concentrating on doing it. Pete handed it over to me. I ran it for 9 months. I handed it over to a lady called Katie, who handed it over to Adrienne, who handed it back to me eventually, and I've been looking after it for the past year, my second time in charge. It's not funded anymore. I do it. We do it for kind of as a shop window for the rest of the stuff that I do. Like, work with a lot of arts organisations with their online presence, so it's useful for that, and because I kind of missed it when I wasn't doing it. So that's Created in Birmingham. The audience for that is kind of dispersed across. We've got the website, obviously. We've got quite a few RSS subscribers to that, which is pretty much half the number of people who are fans of the Facebook page. Should probably be putting more effort into the Facebook page, seeing as that's where the bigger audience is these days. In fact, it's not too far off from Twitter either, and that gets underused. It's always been concentrating on the website, but we're kind of getting to the point where the website is pretty much there to feed the social media profiles, which is kind of an interesting. So I don't know whether that's
is it kind of like a reverse feeding where you're putting the content up on the site and then you're saying out on Twitter and Facebook and whatever else it's here. So more people say on that, and then they go and read it on the site. So you can't put up a huge feature on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. So.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's like that. But there's probably more stuff, more platform-specific stuff that I could be doing on Facebook or Twitter or whatever else that that I'm not. So, I mean, that might be a consideration. It doesn't necessarily have to be a website that you use. You can set something up on Facebook and have something perfectly good, which might get traction quicker with an audience. It's one thing I've not seen in all the discussions of hyperlocal stuff. I've not seen, people always talk about hyperlocal websites and the widgets you can put on them and all the rest of it. I don't see as much discussion about hyperlocal Facebook pages.
That was the first thing that struck me when I started thinking about and being told about hyperlocal stuff, was that by and large, personally, I don't care. Not gone to any of the, you know, even the Birmingham City Council stuff. If there's something going on locally, I find out about it through genre rather than it being because it's local. Like, there's an event on in the Arcadian tonight called Film Rats. And I know about that because I'm into film and I'm into indie film and I'm into live music, not because it's a hyper-local thing. And the best example I could think of when I was trying to think about hyperlocal was, the Flapper and Firkin.
Yeah.
There was that apparently erroneous campaign a few years ago It was going to be closed down. Apparently, it was all a big misunderstanding. But there was a huge drive for it on Facebook to, you know, save the flapper and to get more people aware of the flapper. And that seems to me much more effective and noticeable than like a startup hyperlocal site or blog that I'd have never have come across.
They seem to serve, but I know what you mean. They're never going to be. Not everyone reads the news for starters, or watches the news. So your audience is always going to be tempted by the fact that some people just aren't going to be interested. But there will be some. It's just trying to work out whether you're looking for a large audience. Whether it's quite funny. I'm working with a choreographer at the moment whose take on this project we're doing is she doesn't care if it's not popular. She doesn't care if only five people see it. It's like, really? Brilliant. That's great. What else to say about Created in Birmingham? The other interesting thing about Created in Birmingham is, and I've kind of, well, not messed this up, I've just changed it slightly, is that it was interesting how when Pete got bored of it, he handed it on to someone. And when I had done it for long enough, I felt like the best thing to do would be to hand it on to someone else and keep it fresh. And as far as sustainability goes, I know someone who ran a mailing list in Sheffield. They built it up to, over 3 years, they built it up to 7,000 subscribers. And the three of them doing it, and they just did it in their spare time. It was about events and things. It was a weekly thing. And they got bored of it, and it just sort of slowly fizzled out and stopped. And that was it. And I was talking to him about Created in Birmingham. He was saying it was interesting, like having a mechanism, even though we didn't really think of it as such, but for handing projects over to people. And that's one thing that actually Pete, who started CIB, this is very much his ethos, he started the Flickr meets. I think he organised the first couple and then let someone else do it, and just felt no ownership over it. Created in Birmingham. He was instrumental in starting that, but then got bored of it and thought there's no merit to me hanging on to something that just fizzles out and dies, and just handed it on for no tangible reward. But then you've got those kinds of things aren't forgotten. It's always going to be attributed back to Pete. It's always the thing that he did. And actually, I think starting things up that can be handed on in that way is actually a bit of an art. There's not many people that do it. So I think that's quite interesting about it. The other thing that was odd about that was when I took it over, it had won a Media Guardian Award for Best Independent Blog. There is an half a sense of stage fright about taking over a community of 1,000 odd people that were always used to a certain approach by a certain person, and coming in and having my own idea of how I wanted to do it and how I wanted to bring a couple of other people in to write and do bits of video and things for the site. It's a luxury starting something that already has an audience, because part of your job's already done for you. But on the other hand, yeah, it doesn't. For the first few, you do. The first post takes a couple of days to write, and then you're kind of always checking it for typos and delete and start again, things like that. And then you realise no one actually cared, and you could have just, it didn't matter. So that's Created in Birmingham. I don't know if anyone's got any questions specifically about it.
Yes, I have more or less two questions. One is about more basically what we just said before. If you had to engage with the culture and arts community more offline through your work and social meetings and everything, or if you also had to do some work online to engage with the community?
Actually, funnily enough, the promotion for Created in Birmingham is awful. The marketing for it is terrible. But all we've ever done is on the online side of things, the job is done by it linking to everyone else, and that kind of, it's almost like passive-aggressive marketing. It's just kind of, the more you link to other people, the more trackbacks will be out there, the more...
It's a trackback.
Trackback is when you link to a particular blog post from a blog, it quite often depends on the kind of blogging software people are using, but quite often it'll do like a little automated comment just to say this blog links to this post.
I see.
But also, even if it doesn't go up publicly, quite often in the dashboard section of blogs it'll say who's linking to this blog. So that's quite a good way of going about things. When we started, we had a massive, massive blog roll of pretty much every arts-related blog in the city. We got rid of that after a while because it just got unmanageable. There was loads that was out of date. We were always getting people saying, can you add me to your blog roll? Can you add me to your blog? And it was just too much to look after. The reason that was there was because when Creative in Birmingham started 4 years ago, there weren't that many people blogging around the arts generally. The arts and cultures scene online was fairly dead, which is why it was so hard to find everything. And so Creative in Birmingham kind of did the job of... we got a little bit strict about it sometimes. Like, we'll only write about you if the information about your event is online somewhere. So stick a... like, throw up a really quick blog or put something on Flickr or put a document on
Facebook.
Yeah, or something that we can link to. Like, we have to be able to link to it. And that made a lot of people do something to stick their stuff somewhere, just so that we'd link to it. But then there was the knock-on effect of, like, it made them put their stuff online so that others could see it as well, which was slightly tyrannical of us, but they didn't have to do it if they didn't want to link. And it was fine. That was quite useful. So we do. So as far as online goes, literally all we do is link to stuff. Offline, I go to a lot of things. When I first started, I felt that because I was an outsider to arts and culture, I was interested. I went along to things, but I couldn't give you an opinion on what had just been hung in the Icon Gallery, for example. Not a clue. I studied law at university. That's pretty much just can't get much further away from art. So I went along to stuff because I thought, well, if I'm writing about it, I should go along to it and see it and meet people and try and get my head around it. And so, I ended up going to pretty much everything I could do. Got invited along to a lot. Although it's not a closed community, most launches are free and anyone can just wander in. There's no guest list or anything like that. So that was quite good. So going along to a lot of stuff and just becoming one of the usual faces that always turns up. People are so grateful when you turn up to events. it's the best way to make friends with people, just to be there. It's another person they can put on the head count. Talking to people at those events. But I'm still conscious there's, as much as Creative in Birmingham's probably one of the most widely read Birmingham-centric blogs, it's got, compared to the size of the city, it's got a tiny readership. I meet people all the time with no idea what it is. So the community for it is still quite small. Doing the shop was quite useful when we ran the shop in the Bullring. But loads of people came in and said, have you got a website? Yes.
That was just a limited time thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, 3 months.
Yeah, I had a friend who was selling crafts stuff in there.
There's always more you can do on the promotional side of things. I've never written a press release for anything, things like that.
Did you deliberately put Birmingham in the name for search engine optimization?
No. I think the reason for it, and actually our search engine optimization is pretty poor. I sometimes look at the keywords that people are using to find us, and some of the most popular ones are fairly obscure illustrators who haven't got their own websites. But we've written about them and find us through that. But actually, the name came from an earlier discussion. It's kind of the way that this evolved into being a blog. It was originally going to be looking at things like Made in Sheffield, which is a brand name almost in itself. It's a mark of quality. So one of the original ideas was that for there to be a created in Birmingham stamp that you could look at something that was created in Birmingham and say, yes, this is something that speaks for what Birmingham's all about. And so it kind of came from that.
Sort of like the opposite of the old Brummagem Wares thing.
Oh, I don't know that.
Years ago, if something was called a Brummagem Ware, it was meant it was created in Birmingham and was...
Oh, yes, as in just churned out, yeah, probably from somewhere else.
Yeah, like,
yes.
Or like a Birmingham hammer or a that would be a spanner or something like that.
The main thing is that Pete's approach to naming things is incredibly literal.
See, but if you Google Birmingham blog, you're in the top two, I think, or three.
If you Google Birmingham arts or culture, we're nowhere to be seen.
Oh, I see.
Which is, think is the kind of, I'd like us to be higher up, but I'm not a massively keen SEO head.
Do you think the local blogosphere, such as it is now a bit flooded with arts related projects, or would there be room for? Because my background is media journalism, get games and movie reviews, interviews, that sort of thing. So, it sort of from a lazy point of view, it's what I'm most familiar with. It's what I'm already a little bit in touch with in the locality and further afield. But there are a lot of creative initiatives in and around Birmingham. So,
One of the things that was identified as a success factor for Creative in Birmingham was when it's no longer needed, it would have been a success and it can just stop. And we're always quite keen that Creative in Birmingham doesn't become the website. There should be loads of them. So when More Canals Than Venice popped up, brilliant blog run by one of the people who works at the Icon Gallery. In her spare time, it's nothing to do with her work, but it's morecanalsthanvenice.wordpress.com. So Annabelle, who runs that, when that started, I had no idea who it was by. It was really well written by someone who really knew their stuff. That was really good. And it's brilliant for me, because it means I can just link to what she's writing about. I don't have to write so many posts myself. It kind of creates... I think there's kind of an ecology of some of those sites. So us, More Canals Than Venice, inbirmingham.com to some extent.
Birmingham, it's not shit.
Yeah.
Digbeth. Real website.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Digbeth is good. We end up linking to each other a lot, and there's that kind of basis to it. There's also, I mean, pretty much every theatre, arts organisation, gallery or whatever has its own blog, which is great as a publishing tool for them, but very few of them have ever linked to any other website, which is a slight failing, is probably a little bit harder. It's not the be all and end all, but there is an ecology there. So if you were to start something that was in the arts and culture kind of area, then there's always room for another. And More Canals Than Venice is very contemporary art focused, just because that's what Annabelle's interest is.
It's not actually about the spread of canals or, say, Brindley Place.
No, it's More Canals Than Venice is just running
because
off the tagline for Birmingham. But no, it's mainly about contemporary art stuff.
Right.
There's loads that Creative in Birmingham doesn't cover, like. Never tend to cover music because it's just too big, and I don't think anyone's quite tackled music as well as they could have done. The Blue Whale Studios blog is pretty good for indie music. It's gone a bit quiet recently, but it's still good. Birmingham Live does, which is brumlive.com, does gig reviews, and Steve Gerrard, who runs that, sends out reviewers and photographers to gigs pretty much every night. That's really good. I used to write for that and used to help organise it with him. I think he does it on his own now. I've got no idea, because it's a massive hassle trying to get press passes off bands. But So music tends to be underserved. Indie music, not too bad, but Birmingham is meant to have amazing infrastructure for classical and contemporary classical music. There's no one writing about it, I'm aware of. There's really strong reggae, Bangra, and kind of grime hip hop, especially in the north of the city. I don't know anyone writing about it. It's those kinds of things that Birmingham stands. As when people moan about Birmingham not having a music scene occasionally, and it's not entirely true. It's quite dispersed, but there are elements of it that just don't get talked about.
I find anecdotally it hasn't helped that over the last few years the city council's pushed anything even slightly alternative further and further and further out of the city centre, like closing down the academy, and it's now at the on Bristol Road. Half the stuff that was in the Oasis Market and the great, that surrounding bit is now being sort of like sidelined up into the Custard Factory, and I occasionally go down to the Custard Factory, and that's it. It's sort of stuff that I'm interested in, but if it's something you're not aware of, if you're not from Birmingham, you will never go down to the Custard Factory unless you're going to the Custard Factory for a specific reason. So everything gets sort of lost to a degree.
Yeah, no, I think that's a problem. I think there's always room for another one, no matter what area.
I have a small question about official sources, because you're covering the arts and culture, and how do you find it dealing with, because you said that many things are that the cinema or the place has a website or have to have an online presence to be in there, but how do you deal with official sources, with big press offices and all of that, when you started? I imagine that now you are recognized as a big medium, or at least as someone with a presence. But when you started, it may have been either more difficult to get attention from the Birmingham City Council press office, or...
To be honest, we ignored them. And for a long while, it was all about what we wanted to write about, not what they wanted to send us. And quite often we'd find things that were interesting, write about them, and that'd be the end of it. If they found out that we'd written something about them, then fine. But we always just carried on as if they didn't exist. And that, I think, is something to do with the kind of outsider role that we have. Like, we don't know these people. We think something interesting is happening, and so we might write about it. But otherwise, we're not asking for permission. We're not asking. Mm-hmm. We don't tend to just go off what we know about already. We weren't kind of proper journalists in any sense, and quite often you can get around it just by linking off to something else and just not having an opinion about it. Just saying, go and have a look at this. This looks like it might be interesting. Or I went to this thing last night and I saw a film. I didn't get it at all, but there were lots of people there and they seemed happy, so brilliant. We didn't tend to do that. The only times where it came up was there was a marketing campaign run by Marketing Birmingham called Feel the Heat, which got a little bit of flack. And that was one of the times that Created in Birmingham got noticed in a slightly negative way by a kind of an organisation. And that's because... And that wasn't really Created in Birmingham as such. It was commenters on the site who... I think Pete wrote about this campaign, completely neutral, just said, this is the current campaign that Marketing Birmingham have done. I think it might have been... You had an idea that people weren't going to be entirely impressed with it. But lots of people in the comments just said, that's not very good, or words to that effect. And I think that was, this was a few years ago now, but it was one of the first times that there had been a reasonably well-read public forum for that kind of conversation about those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So these organisations communication channel back to give that kind of feedback. 99.9% of Creative in Birmingham is happy and fluffy and good news and all the rest of it, but we tend to leave it to the commenters for the negative stuff, because it's kind of it's easier that way. And there's always more good stuff to write about than that. I try to make it easy for people to get in contact to send stuff. So there's a contact form on the site, and the email address is there, and my picture's on the site, so when I go to stuff, people can see, people might recognise me to talk to, and things like that. And I'm awful, absolutely awful about replying to emails and anything. There are currently just over 1,100 unread emails on the Creating Birmingham account, most of which are press releases and don't expect a reply. But I do trawl through, and if someone sends a more personal message or has a question, then I'll answer all of those. I get asked some really odd things, like someone once got in touch saying, "Hi, I'm looking for a sculptor to do a recreation of a brass statue, but to make it out of cheese for some cheese festival." Right. Well, there's a bit of a role which is tourist information almost. So I do a fair amount of that. I'll tell people that always send press releases through to this email address. We won't necessarily use everything, but just add us to your mailing list and we'll get your stuff through. It just becomes a dumping ground for all of that. There's still some quite large organisations in the city that don't send us stuff and have never tried to get in touch. The Rep Theatre's probably the most notable ones. They don't send us much stuff. We don't go chasing after them. I write about them occasionally because they do interesting things, but otherwise, that's
What do you know about blogs that are outside of the arts and culture field? Or a need? What kind of blogs is there a need for, in your estimation, in Birmingham?
It's a tricky one, that. I think the most important thing is, if you're going to be writing about something for an extended period of time, then choose something that interests you.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to find something that there is a perceived need for, but that isn't being served, because once you start writing about something, you need to be quite interested to keep on top of it, to have that motivation. So if it can be something that that you're interested in, if you're interested in arts and culture, okay, there's a fair number of them around, but that doesn't mean that there isn't room for another one. There's an ecology that you can fit into. And
what I was least thinking of is I'm involved with a local group of comic creators called MC Squared. We did a launch event down at the Custer Factory for our first graphic novel a few years ago, and we've just done anthology releases since, and we usually sell them at conventions and bits and stuff, but we're quite unfocused, and a lot of the time it's like it's the herding cats kind of thing. It's trying to get like 30 or 40 different creative people to come together and actually put out a physical product. But we've not really done much in the way of like a web presence, and there seems to be quite a burgeoning scene of comics enthusiasts and would-be creators and professional creators in or near Birmingham.
Yeah, that's a good jump-off point to do something like that. I mean, the Birmingham the comic festival that's here every year, the Birmingham Zine Festival, and people like Capsule, who are event promoters, do a monthly zine that they get people to contribute to, and there's been a couple of other get-togethers of that sort. I don't know anyone talking about who's kind of talking about all that stuff kind of in the round and trying to raise the local profile of that particularly. There's scope for something like that. I don't see why not. There is, like I say, a kind of burgeoning interest in self-publishing, taking that away from just the virtual stuff, going back to, like the Dirty Bristow magazine that was produced, was, had that kind of, came out of that kind of interest, creating a physical product. So yeah, there's scope for something like that as well. I was going to tell you about West Midlands Dance, which was a site that I set up almost by accident about 18 months ago, maybe a bit more, which is, just as a quick rattle through, it's westmidlandsdance.com, which I did a bit of consulting on. There was a project called Dance TV. I'm not quite sure where that's at the moment, but it was going to be online dance videos, mainly contemporary dance, as I understood it. They got me to do a day's work figuring out how some sort of editorial section of the website might work, and they wanted to serve the UK and especially the regions and not just concentrate on London. So one of the things that I said for that is how most dance stuff goes on in London, that's the kind of biggest place for it, but have support some sort of regional blog, get a person in each area. There's regional dance development agencies that, so Dance Exchange in the West Midlands that has the remit for promoting dance in that kind of area. So piggyback on those areas and get someone just to write out all the dance stuff happening there. And if you need to commission something in particular, go and tell them to interview someone or cover an event. And you can cherry pick content from the regions and into the kind of the main editorial strand. And so this kind of regional blog might look like this. And I spent half an hour putting together westmidlandsdance.wordpress.com and chucked three articles on there and said, there you go, it would look like this. And all you have to do is anytime, and then, yeah, just put regular content on there and see how it goes. I'd always been conscious that I don't write about a lot of dance I'm created in Birmingham, or didn't. But there's a lot happening in the area. There's Dance Exchange and there's the Royal Ballet and various others. So I set it up and thought, that's actually quite interesting. I'll carry that on. So every time I came across anything dance-related, I'd post it on West Midlands Dance, hoping that one day Dance TV would maybe pick up and I could get paid for doing it, because I'd have built the site up a bit and that would be some, they'd pay me to do it properly. Didn't happen. But I worked for the International Dance Festival 2010, and one of the things we did was some of my work on that. I put some extra time into building up West Midlands Dance, kind of to find where the audience for dance in the region was. So that was starting, it was a similar kind of website to Created in Birmingham, just concentrating on dance, and it was on the region. But that had no audience to start with. I think after a year we had about 50 subscribers and 100 people visiting the site a day, and a few hundred Facebook fans and the rest of it. Not huge. It was mainly people who were interested in the dance industry rather than people who were interested in dance generally. And it was also interesting doing something that was region-wide as well, because, I mean, people have said that people aren't interested in their region. People are interested in their community, and this is like going back to the hyper-local thing. It's like the idea of what is local to people. Is it... the local shop is just down the end of the road. The local football club might be 10 miles away. Like, local's quite a shiftable kind of concept. So trying to work out what people identify with. Do people identify with the West... Do people think I'm a West Midlander? Therefore, this site is the kind of thing that... so it has quite a broad... I mean, it takes hours to travel from one side of the West Midlands to the other, depending on traffic. So there's a lot to cover, but... we built that up in the same way as Created in Birmingham. It was I went along to a lot of things. I we linked to a lot of people. Again, there were hardly any dance organisations putting out information in a way that we couldn't even find them, let alone Google them or to write about them or link to their websites. Went along to ArtsFest a couple of years ago, and there were hundreds of dance companies performing there. And I was just going around with a list, just like writing all these names down. It's like, right, so these people do exist. It's like, how do you find what they're doing? Because some of them are quite good. But so that was interesting. I probably wouldn't want to do something that was West Midlands wide again. I think keeping things, if you're doing anything geographically focused, then a little bit narrower than that.
Yeah. Literally just sprung to mind, for some reason my mind made the leap from dance to martial arts. Which Kapir is a martial art, involves dancing. I heard like a snort from this area. Anyway, to your knowledge, is there anything that focuses on that sort of community within Birmingham? Because I know there's dozens and dozens of sort of locally run clubs, and they'll all have their own sort of federation and sort of sporting body that they adhere to, but not something.
Those kinds of things, if you start searching for them, dance classes as well fall into this, is that a lot of the search results you'll get are directories and for those kinds of courses, and that's pretty much all you can find about these things. I don't see anyone writing about it. I don't know many sports bloggers around. There will be, there are very active forums for Birmingham City and Aston Villa and things like that. I don't know whether there's people blogging about particular sports or particular teams or leagues. I don't know a great deal about it. That might be something to look into.
What's the difference between a forum and a sports blogger?
A forum is like a discussion board, so anyone can come along
like
and talk about it.
On the team's website, you mean?
Yeah, or even independently. So there's unofficial discussion groups.
Just go and chat.
Yeah. Okay. So they'll have someone running it, but there won't necessarily be much of a kind of editorial.
My housemate is a big Everton fan. He's always on this forum called like Chuff to be Blue, and it's just fan run for Everton supporters. So it's nothing actually. There's no affiliation between the people running the site and the people running the football club. They're just entirely fan run, fan driven.
The other thing that I think Paul wanted me to talk about was the News Dash project we've been running, which learned all sorts of lessons from that. For the sake of your projects, I think the thing we did with Creating in Birmingham, being a bit outside and talking about others at a slight remove, is quite useful. Actually trying to work with an existing organisation can be quite difficult, especially if it's a community one, it's volunteer run. Scheduling diaries is such a pain. A lot of these organisations are run on a shoestring by people in their spare time. They achieve a remarkable amount, but they're always incredibly stretched, and they often don't have a lot of time to give to dedicate to others in the same way. So I wouldn't rule it out, depending on who you want. If there was a particular organisation you wanted to work with, then it can certainly be done. But it's just something to bear in mind. They're also a lot of them aren't organised in the way that company or especially if it's not a full-time organisation, they don't have a communications person or a kind of head of operations or that kind of thing that you can to kind of take a lead on these things. I think the standing slightly outside of organisations can work to your benefit quite well. I'd also say tackle something that is particularly interesting to you, because the enthusiasm comes through in that. There was, you see examples of it all the time. A lot of company blogs are rubbish because people don't want to be writing them. The chief executive gets an email saying, we need a blog post from you by tomorrow afternoon. And they hammer out 400 words. And you can tell that their heart was never in it. And it's never worth reading past the first line. Because they haven't got anything to say about it, and or no insight. Or so that's... so yeah, go for something that kind of makes you want to write about it. So whether it's an interest or a cause, or whether it's a local area, if you're particularly interested in a local area, or if there's an existing community that you can kind of use to support you. I know was Andrew Brightwell, who ran Grounds, I think it was grounds.posterous.com, he was one of the previous students. He ran that from Urban Coffee Company, and he liked sitting in there and writing about stuff that was going on about the community. I don't particularly know his motivation for doing it, but I think part of the fact that he was... The Urban Coffee Company is a nice place to work and to base something out of. And so any sort of hook that gives you some sort of support for that is going to help. Have a think about the kind of the size of the audience you want for it. There's nothing wrong with an audience of 10 people if you are serving that that audience and being useful to them. If you're looking to promote a cause or an organisation and get them a wider audience, that that kind of has its own approach. And you might want to tackle it in a slightly slightly different way. What else? It's mainly the enthusiasm that you can't fake. The other thing is to very quickly find out who the other people writing about whatever it is you're writing about, and be nice to them and acknowledge them and see if you can get a leg up from them in whether they'll link to you or... the other really interesting thing that I keep finding is that, and actually it has worked for us a little bit, is once you've got a website, you can go and get an interview with anyone you like. It's the most fascinating thing. And I've seen a few people do this where they, and who have got work through this as well, where what they've done is they've been out of work for or looking for work. They've set up a website around any particular interest, and they've contacted people and said, hi, I've got a website about such and such a thing. I'd like to interview you for it. Only take 15 minutes. And so they'll go off and they'll interview someone. It's just a brilliant excuse to talk to anyone. I don't know why it works as well as it does, but I've seen it a few times now. And actually there's, I don't know if you've, oh, I'm trying to think what site it is. I subscribe to ProBlogger and CopyBlogger, which most of the time are rubbish blogs, but occasionally you'll get some really good tips on them. There was a guest post by some guy who set up a bodybuilding website, and he set up this website and he wrote a list of like the top people in bodybuilding, like the big stars of the scene or whatever, and he emailed the like 20 of them and said, I'd like to interview you for my site. And he got replies from about 10 or 15 of them saying, yeah, all right. They did it over Skype, or they did it over the phone, or by email or whatever. It's amazing what people will give their time for. And so he had a new site about bodybuilding with interviews with some of the top people in the field. And it was that easy to do. So
it's one of those things where if it isn't a niche interest or audience, that the central figures in it aren't necessarily getting their doors knocked down for interviews. It's not like if you were trying to interview, I know, like David Beckham or, yeah, I know, Tom Cruise or somebody. If it's something that's niche, like, you know, bodybuilding or comics or whatever, they're not necessarily going to have, you know,
E or New York Times.
Yeah, it's true. Sometimes you build it up in your head and think these people are the sort of they're huge, but they're not necessarily as big and in the grand old scheme of things. I know someone who you heard of David McCandless? Does information is beautiful? Does data visualizations beautiful things? I know someone who was running an event and wanted to get him along to it, and just thought, well, I'll email him, but he's going to be far too busy to ever even reply to this. He's David McCandless. Which, if you're in that kind of field and interested in that kind of thing, then yeah, he's an impressive guy. He's done some really good stuff. But, you know, he emailed back a few days later and said, yeah, love to come down, cheers. It's like people are surprisingly open to that. The least you can do is ask.
That's so, big fish in the pond sort of thing.
Yeah, so that's if you're doing something that's, especially if it's not even geographically relevant, that don't be afraid to reach out to some of the big names in it and just chance your arm and see if people will make a contribution to whatever you're doing, because it's a great way to attract a bit of attention. So once you've got, if you're writing on a certain niche, get an interview with one of the top people in that niche, and other people will. It's the sort of thing that people will spread around and find.
I found that people who you would, like you say, you would never think would come on like a two-bit radio show or agree to an interview are more than willing. It's like I had a show on community radio and we had Uri Geller on. You know, and he was more than happy to come on. In fact, I couldn't get rid of him. You know, it's just they're more than happy. You know, and he was in the middle of doing 101 other things, and yet he was, and, you know, I had the world snooker champion on the phone ringing me up at work saying, hey, you'd like me to come on your radio show? I'm like, yeah, okay. You know, they're just more than willing. A lot. Yeah. I mean, especially phone interviews, because people don't have to leave the homes, or, you know, and it's quite easy to record a phone call, and if they're doing an interview, they will give you permission to do it.
What did you use to record phone calls?
Is it on the phone that you can just click?
Oh, I mean like through a landline or something.
I've got a thing that plugs in.
Yeah.
It's like a sticker at the end. You know those little arrow guns?
Saturn cap.
Yeah. And it sticks to the back of the earpiece of the phone and it records it.
Speaking of which, is your experience with devoting time to develop multimedia for your sites? Because I find it that if you're doing a blog, getting time to do multimedia, not only recording an interview, but also putting together a very tight video. What do you think about this?
My general... it's one of those things that I'd like to spend more time on. A lot of the creative and learning stuff is... in fact, I don't know if you've read the site and seen, there's a standard set way that those posts go. Title, usually very descriptive. Quite often, an image of some sort usually takes up most of the pain. And then underneath, such and such a thing is happening. Quote, link. And that's it, like every time, because it's the quickest way of getting all the information out. And like, I don't write a lot on that site, really. There's quite a few posts, but
yeah, you're doing like 6-7 posts a day, right?
I think it's trying to keep down to 2, maybe 3.
Okay.
I've got Alex who works with me, who she writes quite a lot of stuff on it at the moment. I'll chuck her stuff, especially the kind of those kinds of write something about this person, he's doing something interesting, or this event's coming up, can you stick that on the blog? And she'll do a kind of quick thing. But the idea is to link people on to further things. So we don't do a lot of, there aren't a lot of articles on there that are there for its own sake. Our thing is, the tagline's always been linking up Birmingham's creative community, so the idea is you just link to other stuff. It's not about creative in Birmingham necessarily. Had a girl called Hannah Hannah Waldron, she's with The Guardian now, but she was she ran the Harborne she ran a website in Birmingham, it was brilliant, I can't remember the name. Bourneville Village, that was it. She set that up. she was really into her dance, and so she was working on the West Midlands Dance website, and she did some really nice articles, some really long interviews and things. And my take on that is that people never read those things. People will read the first paragraph if you're lucky. This was kind of exemplified with, she went and did an interview with a ballet dancer at Birmingham Royal Ballet. It was a really good interview that she did. She knows the subject backwards. It was a really good piece. And at the bottom, in bold, and we've got two tickets to give away for the first night of this thing. It's like 40, 50 quid's worth of tickets for the ballet. And she sat there just like checking the email address, and like, no one entered this competition. I saw her doing this, and I just thought, well, a couple of days later, it's like, how's the competition going? It's like, no one's entered. Like, okay, I think the problem is that you put the competition, the bit where you want someone to do something, right at the bottom of a really long article, and no one reads words on websites. It's the most frustrating thing for publishing stuff, but no one actually reads those things. There are exceptions. I will read a lot. But so we ended up redoing the, putting the competition up again, and flagging it up, and we got a whole load of people entering it, but it was just buried at the bottom. So on the one hand, I'd like to write more considered pieces on it. There is an audience for that. I'm quite down on it, but there really, you can write more than that. But I'm also conscious that if you're producing a stream of stuff quite regularly, then I haven't got a great deal of time to put towards it. It does take up a lot of time. Trying to keep on top of all those emails is another time cost as well. Going out to these events as well. Like, if you take up all the time that's involved in doing Creative in Birmingham and do a pie chart of it, then there's a chunk that's just replying to people and a chunk of going to stuff, and then like a sliver is writing stuff for the website. And that's the stuff that I'd like there to be more of.
When you go to an event, you're sort of, what are you looking to get out of it? Would you just like beforehand put up, this is happening here, and then going to it is just almost reward for it? Or would you write a retrospective piece on it afterwards? Or
if it's no, quite often I don't write up. I'd like to write more stuff, things that I've been to. And don't. I think that's. I was actually someone emailed me the other day saying, "Hi, could you start, if you're writing about events, could you only write about events that are kind of a week away? Because I keep missing that you keep writing about things on the day it happens, and I miss it." They emailed back and said, "Sometimes I only find out on the day, so that's when it goes up at the last minute." But secondly, like, we're not a listing site. Like, you go to Livebrum or Visit Birmingham or something if you want listings. I'd like us to do more of, instead of telling people what's going to happen, telling people what happened. I think that would be more interesting, almost, rather than having to go off a press release or what I'm being told an event is going to be like. Reporting back and saying, it was brilliant, there were loads of people there, this funny thing happened, or not many people turned up, really. It was a shame because it was really good, or it was interesting.
That sort of raises another point. Like, when you're doing something that's quite niche, where do you draw the line at biting criticism? You know, if something is terrible, you might not want to say this was terrible because you don't want to alienate either the people directly involved in that or the community that's attached to it. Or...
And that's the interesting thing with knowing a lot of the people I'm writing about these days. It does get more complicated. And that's probably one of the reasons why Creating in Birmingham is a bit more fluffy and happy than it might have been, because I'm a bit more aware of the context in which things happen. So if something's rubbish, I might know why it was rubbish and have a bit of sympathy for that, and or want to spare someone's blushes. And there isn't really an answer to that one, other than not writing about it, or writing about it and putting a whole lot of context into it. A good example of that, actually, there's a project called Weevee, W-E-V-E-E. It's It's a really interesting online project that takes archive footage and allows you to edit it together. And I know the people who've developed it, and it's an interesting thing, but I think it's flawed. It's quite good, it seems to me, to be quite good in an, if you take it in schools or as an exhibition piece, and you can get people to, and you get kids or old people as well to use it. But I wrote a thing saying, like, this is nice and all, but the problem is that you're using archive content that is really locked down. Like, once you've spent however long creating video, you can save it in that system, but I can't embed it on my site, or I can't download it and show my mum at home, or...
Can I even link to it, like, YouTube style? Or?
I don't know, to be honest. And it has developed a bit since I last saw it as well. And they've got some fantastic archive material in there as well. So I ended up writing this really long post about Weavy, because I didn't want to just say, yeah, it's rubbish, because it's not rubbish. And that would have been entirely short-sighted. And I knew the people who... It took me ages to write that thing, because I was just stepping on and just being a bit too... probably a bit too careful about not offending people when I wouldn't have offended anyone. So it does get a bit more complicated in that sense. I mean, I used to do music reviews and like live reviews and album single reviews. New Model Army. I can never go to one of their gigs because their fans will lynch me. I didn't like one of their albums and they let me know what they thought of my opinion. But I think as long as you're being constructive about stuff, then there's no harm in that. The other thing that I've noticed actually is quite a lot of arts organisations, if they get any criticism, they don't have to take it to heart. And it becomes the biggest problem. And almost from the kind of administrative side of things. I wrote something about an organisation. They put a call out for some... They wanted some people to... It was an award ceremony that was happening. And they wanted a designer to do their menus and invitations. They won't... No money to pay for it, but they said they'd give them a couple of seats, and it was like 100 quid a ticket at the table, and a bottle of champagne, and your work will be on show in front of all these people. So I put it on the site, and a few of the commenters said, oh, I bet they don't expect other people to provide stuff for free. It's always the designers that have to provide free artwork and all the rest of it. And it's a big bugbear with graphic art designers especially. And I got an email from, a really long email saying, responding to me, to this criticism that they had. And I got another email from someone, like, this must have been a really big issue for them in the organisation. I don't want to cause that kind of, like, they're quite busy enough as it is. That, so yeah, all that kind of stuff does make it slightly more... that said, there are plenty of organisations around the city that need a bit of a kicking. And should get a kicking. I tend to be a little bit more tongue-in-cheek these days. That's how I do it, actually, come to think of it. I tend to be a little bit... I'll post... I won't be as direct about any criticism, or I'll put things up there for other people to criticise rather than doing it myself, which is kind of a slightly weaselly way of doing it, but it's the best that I've come up with so far.
How important would you say design is to a blog or a site or an online presence? Because, frankly, I'm terrible at web design. like I can't even get WordPress to look like it wasn't constructed by a squirrel running across the keyboard.
Really not very, I don't think. Another Created in Birmingham thing, actually. This, when it was originally set up, part of the point was to show that you could set up a website which is just WordPress with a free theme on it, and all you're paying for is the hosting and the domain name, and you don't need to pay someone to design you a big flashy website. That this is within reach of, I think, hosting and a domain name, sort of 60 quid a year, I think, they were paying for it, and that's all you need. So I think there's a lot to be said. And once people are subscribing, and if they're using RSS or they're getting stuff through email or whatever, then the design doesn't make much of a difference, as long as it's legible and... That's about it, to be honest.
What about using, if you're trying to do it on like a student budget, if you get the domain name, but then
set it up as a redirect so it goes to whatever .wordpress.com or whatever.
Yeah, that's fine. More Canals Than Venice is, I think that's, I don't think she's even bought the domain name for it.
Right.
Oh no, she has. But yeah, she does exactly that. Right. And that's a really good blog, quite a few subscribers to it. That's all you need.
Yeah. It cuts out the hosting costs then, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was talking to someone the other day who's thinking about taking all his WordPress self-hosted sites and shifting them onto WordPress.com because he's fed up with having to maintain them. And you can overcomplicate things. You do get far too many people that will spend all their time fiddling with the design of their site and making sure their sidebars are neatly ordered. And I think to a certain extent it's important, but it's more important to have content on there and spend the time doing that. I think if you've got the basics, stick an about page on there that explains what the site is and who it is that's involved, and a contact page so that people can contact you. That's pretty much all you need as far as the kind of the infrastructure for a website is concerned.
So content is more important than design and image. And
yeah. Right. If you want to go nuts with it, then the best thing I've found, because I can't design anything, I'm rubbish at that. There's a premium WordPress theme called Thesis, which is magical. And it costs $40, maybe $50, something like that. Mm. But you install that theme and you can customize every part of it. You can change the number of sidebars and the width and the colors and the images and the fonts and font colors and all sorts of things. It's amazing.
And what's it called, sorry?
Thesis. Yeah. Thesis.
Oh, okay.
So I found that really useful, but even that is more than you'd need. They use that on, I think, a lot of the big guys that talk about marketing and blogging. So Copy Blogger uses it, Pro Blogger does, Chris Brogan, come across him. A lot of those kind of, they've got tens of thousands of readers. But otherwise, WordPress.com, free theme building.
If you're using a premium theme on WordPress, how do you alter the default images of the theme if you want to? Because I've been messing around, I've got my own domain name and I've never really done anything with a site, but I've got it hosted privately and I've got an FTP access to it, and I can kind of go into a specific folder and change the redirect for default header image to my header image to whatever. Okay.
I'll let him do it.
Yeah, cool.
One question. Do you think WordPress or Joomla is better to use for our project? So.
I don't know. I use WordPress because I'm comfortable with it and I know what to do with it.
It's more about blogs, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if you want to make a website.
If it's websites, it's. I don't know. I use whatever you're comfortable with, whatever. To be honest, I can't build websites, which is why I use WordPress.
Okay.
If it's anything more complicated, then I'll talk to a website developer and I'll get them to do something. But no, a lot of the stuff that I do is with is blogging based, and so I'll use something like WordPress for it. Or Tumblr. Quite like Tumblr at the moment. Posterous, they're all good. Anything else?
Well, I just wanted to ask about the presence on social media. How do you do the balance between your personal? I have tried to see a bit, but I want to ask you, how do you balance what you publish in your personal account and what you publish on the account for Creating in Birmingham, or I see more the difference in Facebook. That it can be split. But for example, in Twitter, which is more professional.
Facebook, I don't use Facebook a great deal from a personal point of view. But I get a lot of people who will add me as a friend through Created in Birmingham. And quite often I'll accept the friendship, but I've got separate security settings for friends, and I've got I've got a, it's a Dropbox thing that you just tick created in Birmingham, because I know that's why they're getting in touch with me, and it'll probably be so they can invite me to events and things, and kind of that can be quite useful. It's a way of getting information. So, but I lock it down so they can hardly see anything, because I don't know these people. As far as Twitter's concerned, I've got Twitter accounts for Creative Birmingham and my company as well, and West Midlands Dance and various others. As my personal thing tends to be about personal stuff, although I don't think I've tweeted anything in nearly 2 weeks now, not for any particular reason, but that'll be personal stuff. Sometimes I'll talk about Creative in Birmingham stuff or work stuff, but not so much really. I know some people who, so my girlfriend works for the Times, she's got a personal account and she's got a professional account, and she has quite a big split between the, her work account is very popular, her personal account is, it's open so people can follow her, but on that she'll be talking about being bored on train journeys back to Birmingham and things like that, whereas work will be work related links and stuff to do with the projects that she's doing at work, and a lot more on that side of things. So she, that's kind of 9 till 5, and then the rest of the time she's got a personal one for slightly more for her personal interests basically.
So you just mentioned you've got one for your company, is that one of the ones you discussed earlier, or is that something completely separate?
No, separate. My company's Meshed Media,
right?
And that one, it's there in case anyone wants to subscribe to the blog through it, and I'll also I go through phases of using it just to kind of document what I've done that day or what we're doing, so that I can look back on it in years to come and think, ooh, that was an interesting day we did. But it'll be sort of, today we're doing this and this and working with this person, and that kind of thing. Don't put a lot of effort into it. I just kind of, it's there for, partly so that I've reserved it so no one else can get it, and partly because I'll use it in a kind of low-level fashion if I ever want to pick it up and use it better. I mean, it flags up in the bio that if you want to talk to people, then talk to myself or Ian or Alex for actual conversations with the people behind it. I think that's quite important.
So what do you do with Meshed Media? Is it production?
Meshed Media is we work with a lot, mainly arts organisations, on the stuff that they do online. So worked with the International Dance Festival. We did a kind of their online strategy, worked with their marketing team to work out what they were going to do online and how, and then helped deliver it as well. So produced a lot of blog content, live blogged one of the, they did a debate with kind of leading politicians on the arts and culture side in the run-up to the election, which was good timing. Live streamed some of the events that that they did. Looked after their Facebook page and that kind of stuff. We do occasional social media campaigns for big brands, which I'm not allowed to talk about because it's all white labeled and I have non-disclosure agreements. So we usually have, we do one of those every couple of months, which are quite interesting to do. We do a lot of training with people on how they approach this online stuff. So we'll go and talk to galleries or arts organisations about how they can up their game and be a bit more friendly and conversational and engaging with the work they're doing.
So it's kind of midway between sort of like marketing and PR and training, with the online focus.
A lot of the stuff we do is commissioned through the marketing departments, right, because it's communications based. But we're increasingly getting onto the kind of infiltrating the creative side of things as well. So working with Apples and Snakes, which is the national performance poetry organisation that do stuff all over the country, and I've done sessions with their poets. Do like a day-long session. The morning will be talking to their poets about how they can use the internet as a performance space, pretty much, you think what they what someone can do when they stand up on a stage with a microphone and tell a poem. It's like, well, you haven't got a stage, you've got the internet. How do you, what can you do there that's interesting and creative and gets the same sort of thing across? And then the afternoon we'll do some slightly more hard-headed marketing, kind of, right, if you want to get people to read your stuff, or if you're going to set up a website or whatever, then do it like this. I'm working with a choreographer on a... she's done a performance... she's done a contemporary... a piece of contemporary dance called Five Soldiers, which she's got some... she's now doing a project to film it and put it online in an interesting, slightly experimental, innovative way. And so I'm working with her, a TV production company, and we're doing the kind of the web side of that. So we've got a developer to help. We've come up with some concepts for how this might look on a website or in a video player or something, and we've got a developer who's helping us to actually make it happen. Stuff like that.
And are you finding any immediate impact yet on the various cuts? Because the art sector seems to be getting hammered pretty hard.
There's, I've seen some people who've left jobs who haven't been replaced. So that's like the early stages of it. There's, everyone's been coming up with their business cases for, they're modelling for 25% cuts. But last I heard, people were getting quite nervous that they were going to get 40% cut in their funding, which you think you take an organisation, no matter how well run they are, you chuck 40% of their money away and they're going to have issues. There's an organisation called Script which have just announced they're closing. They lost their regular funding. Arts organisations have regular funding and project funding. So the regularly funded arts organisations, there's 300 or 600, I can't remember now, across the country. They get an amount of funding per year to do their stuff. They lost that, so they've been applying for funding for each project they've been doing instead, but they've shut up shop, I think last month, because they couldn't sustain themselves. They won't be the last. There's a gallery somewhere in the West Midlands, which I don't think I'm supposed to know about, has lost a massive chunk of local authority funding. So that's before they get their whatever cuts are coming through the Arts Council side of things. So that's going to hurt them. There's going to be places closing for a few days a week. There'll be more staff going unreplaced. It's not going to be happy times for a lot of people. On my side of things, the funding, everyone's running off funding that was set 3 years ago, and there hasn't been much of a reduction in it yet. So, organisations still will have money to do stuff. The Arts Council seem quite keen on digital media being a good thing in terms of cost savings. They're still maintaining a couple of their projects to promote that with organisations. I don't think we've quite seen how it's gonna come through. We'll find out in the next spending reviews in the next
4th of October.
Yeah, next few weeks.
The 20th.
After that, I think people will start having figures to work with, and they'll start hearing who's going to cut what. Any more? Has anyone got an idea of what they'd like to cover? Like what their project's going to be about? See, I imagine you want to do sports in some format. You're thinking about...
I've got several ideas. as a group, we're kind of looking, like I said, the cuts broadly, but we've not really narrowed down to like a specific focus or a specific area.
We have many angles that we have to discuss yet. One of the angles, for example, which is more location based, is looking at how, for example, the retail sector and businesses in general, for example, in the city center or the retail quarter, are dealing with the downturn, also with a positive focus, so that to highlight and to showcase
good examples of what people, what shops are coming up with in order to cope with the downturn. So to cover the downturn, but also the opportunities for recovery, because covering only the cuts can be quite negative and depressing.
That might be quite an interesting one if you're looking for Friday. Independent retail around the city centre, there isn't a lot. It's kind of one of the complaints about Birmingham is that there's chains everywhere.
Shut down. Do you know offhand the plan for what was the Academy? Last I heard anything, it was going to be turned into another mall.
Martineau Galleries, I think it was going to be turned into, but the property companies that were going to do that run into some difficulties. The budgets, with materials, the cost going up, they've put it on hold for 5 years.
Just going off the word galleries, because I live up by Five Ways, and there's what's meant to be the Edgbaston Galleries there. So it's not that, because they levelled that down to brownfield, and it's just being used as temporary parking stuff at the moment. Mm-hmm. But I heard that had been put on hold for 5 years.
I haven't, because I live just a little bit further up that road. I haven't heard what was happening with that place, because they've had the board up there. Definitely the Academy and Oasis area, it's on hold for 5 years, because they've, and that's why they've started, because the story came out in the Birmingham Post that they were starting to offer leases in the Oasis shopping centre again. Because everyone thought they were going to have to move out, and actually they were told they could stay, and in fact they were getting more people in, so that's had a stay of execution.
Which is kind of a shame, because that's one bit that probably does need some, at least surface redevelopment, because it's pretty grotty.
Yeah, it's not inviting.
You were going to say something about independent retail?
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's a lot of, the city centre doesn't have as much independent retailers you might expect from a city this size. The actual retail centre of the city is quite small, really. You've got the Bullring, which is massive, but
it's essentially High Street, New Street Corporation Street.
Yeah, there's not a great deal, and in that area there aren't a whole lot of independent sort of local businesses. Everything, as you say, tends to get pushed away. Rates are quite high, but there are a few around. Retail Birmingham is the name of the business improvement district for the city centre. It's a business improvement district's work on, they take a percentage of, a tiny percentage on top of business rates, and goes into a pot, and that pot is spent on promoting and improving that kind of area. Retail Birmingham have done a couple of projects to highlight the independent retailers around there. And there are some interesting ones when you start sort of winkling them out. But they're going to, I can't imagine life's going to be too much fun for them over the next little while. And if anyone could do with some support or promotion, then they'd be quite interesting to do something with. There's a lot of issues there about how many empty units there are around the city centre, how many of those belong to the council.
I think it's pretty shocking that there's so much repetition as well. Like, we've got four H&Ms, three HMVs, I know, half a quintillion Starbucks. You know, there's just so much repetition in such proximity to each other. You know, if you're in the Ballroom, why would you go over to the Pavilions or for the other H&V, or why would you go over to the Palisades for the other H&M or whatever?
So there's issues around that. There's some interesting characters involved, and it actually leads over to the other one, which is fashion. If there's anything else that doesn't get mentioned on Created in Birmingham, it's fashion. I know there's quite a few fashion students here. I had someone email me the other day asking for, she was emailing Created in Birmingham asking if she could come and do work experience in 2012. Keen. I like that. She was saying, could she come and do some work experience with the fashion editor of Created in Birmingham? I don't know how big she thinks this place is, because it's me, and quite frankly, I'm no fashion editor. I tried to say, I said, well, we don't really do work experience, we haven't got a fashion editor, if you want to talk to someone who does fashion, then, well, actually, there really isn't anyone, and that's quite a big gap. There are some fashion designers around the place. Wrote about one on the site the other day, a guy called Damien Marquez, who did something at London Fashion Week. There's a couple of others around, but at Matthew Bolton College, they do textile design, and like, some of the fashion students there go on to do some quite good things. There's the Jewellery Quarter as well, creating jewellery, and the Jewellery Quarter is a fascinating place as it is. So there's that seems to be a bit of a gap. And you might get some free clothes out of it.
Just if I could run by you one idea that I've been sort of, you know, tracking anyways, is the idea of these cuts that are coming. Mm. And specifically a site or a blog about job losses, because it'll be massive. There'll be tens of thousands of people, right, in Birmingham who will lose their jobs or services or both. Right? Because the idea was that it's fresh, it's new, no one else really will be doing it, and that it could somehow be a voice between the union and the government somehow.
There's the other part of that is the job centres are one of the things that are going to be closed down, replaced with a website, which is not going to be a happy thing for a lot of people. Actually, something to look at is a project called Retooled. I think it's retool.com or .co.uk, which was another Hello Digital project, which worked with people in Longbridge who'd been made redundant. And it was about putting them, helping them to use, the idea was that for them to use the social web, social media and so on, to get back into work, either in by giving them some new skills or by helping them to make connections with other people. They found that a lot of the people who were made redundant in massive swathes, the ones that got into work quickest were the ones that had that were part of networks, whether it was clubs they went to or large families, or they just had a lot of phone numbers. They were saying there was a secretary who on her last day went around taking the phone number of everyone in her section. And she was fairly relentless about it. She got a job a couple of weeks later just from hammering those phone numbers. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be so many more people who are going to be in a similar position. And we'll need some sort of guidance. If the job centre's going, then it's not great timing for that. The what sort of form that might take, whether it's suited to a kind of new stream kind of thing, or the Guardian are doing the thing on arts cuts on the culture section of their thing. It's basically just a blog post, and they're saying if you hear about anything that's affected by the cuts, then post it here, and it's just comments underneath, which is probably the lowest tech way of going about it.
That's what the union is doing as well. They've got Cuts Watch, and they're up to 280 postings, right? Cuts Watch number 280. Mm-hmm. But just it's like a feed.
Yeah. So it's going to be fertile territory over the next little while.
Yeah.
It's got that going for it. Whether you want to be writing about cuts and people losing their jobs for the next little while. Yeah.
Well, but the great thing is that it's event-driven to a certain extent as well, right? It's not like you have to sit there and say, what am I going to put on the blog today?
Yeah.
It's going to be driven by...
Yeah. You won't have to go searching.
There'll be protests, right?
Well, the point Nick Booth made when we spoke to him about it on Friday was the fact that there's lots of hearsay, speculation and rumours surrounding what the cuts are actually going to be, when in fact people need the actual facts. There's lots of scaremongering. And like my point was that you tend to find that when governments say we're going to be cutting this much, they usually then, it's not as bad when they actually inflict the cuts on you, and then they can say they were going to be this bad, but because of the measures we've put in place, it's not quite as bad as it would have been. And so they get a bit of kudos, and it makes people think, thank God it's not as bad. And so it's more positive than having to make these big cuts. So if they say we're going to make 40% cuts, it might be 30% cuts. and then people think, thank God they've got...
Yay! But that's interesting from your point of view in the kind of looking at it from the journalism side of things. Like I say, most of the stuff that I've done has been... I haven't done a great deal in the way of anything that you might accuse of being investigative. It's not a skill set that I have, and it's not been my focus, but to choose something where there is a little bit of delving around to be done, a little ferreting about, and find out when there's questions like, why has this part of an organisation been cut, or why is this programme being cut when this one is as wasteful as it is, and following that kind of following the positioning that goes on before a cut is made, looking at it in absolute terms rather than relatives, and that kind of the 40-30% kind of not as bad as it could have been kind of, could be quite interesting with probably some you could kind of, if you take all the rumours that were just plot them on a graph or something and then point out where exactly it was. Do that for everything. I wonder what that would look like.
That's a good idea.
See whether the rumour mill tends to be how
rumour versus reality,
standard deviation of cuts rumours.
I also thought, I put this in an email yesterday, that I thought it would be interesting. I mean, from my experience of working in the public sector, the last government's solution to most problems was just throw money at it, regardless of whether it did any good, just like chuck money. And I know of schools that, for instance, recarpeted and put new doors in throughout the entire school just to be able to say they'd spent all the money they've been allocated and they haven't used any. You know, they needed all the money that they'd been given, and so it was just spent, whatever they can think to spend it on, will spend it, when they could have quite easily saved money. And I thought it'd be quite interesting to look at the levels of spending in, say, the National Health Service, education, and that before the last government came in, and then the level of the financing of these services when these cuts are in place, and see whether it's essentially just taking it back to the level that it was before without the extra bureaucracy. And
that'd be an interesting thing, actually, looking at, with all the information about spending stuff coming out, finding out how much gets spent in the last 2 weeks before the end of that budget cycle, and see what gets see whether you just get £10,000 being spent on window cleaning all of a sudden.
I know the levels of squandering cash in the public sector are phenomenal. I think I said the other day as well, I know of a deputy head teacher in a school who's going off to Australia next Thursday, midterm, on a holiday. And her and the head teacher at their school both work a day from home. I mean, I've never heard of teachers working from home, but they essentially, they're just having a day off.
Yeah.
But officially, if you ring up, they're attending off-site meetings, but it's on the staff meeting minutes that they're working from home. And, you know, it's just like squandering and wastefulness. And
it's interesting from my perspective, being new to the country, how often it happens that I go, I can't believe they spend money on that. Like when Chris just said, how many shops are owned by council? That's, I find shocking in the retail sector, right? Where I come from, a council would never own a shop. I don't really even really, but I find that crops up several times a day, where I'm going, I can't believe they spend money on this here, public money.
This is why I asked, we're dealing with official
services. I'm afraid I've got to go, I just realised I'm late for a meeting.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Do we?
Do you not? It was on Paul's email.
Oh, in that case, I probably do then.
I was copying the chat, so. You can grab me at that if you want. You're very welcome to. Feel free.
Cheers.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the way they do it here with councils owning retail properties, that they do it almost with the intention of it being a revenue generating thing, like, because that's what they were saying.
Yeah, I get that. I just think it's crazy what the
country's
spending money on. You know, it doesn't happen in.
Also, I wanted to ask about that, because when you mentioned it on the email about like the schooling stuff, is that a case of that they aren't allowed to keep any excess that they have,
at the end of like a funding period, or is it like if they've got that much left over, they'll have that much less in their next budget? Sort of.
Well, that school in question was a new school,
right?
That was given a specific budget to spend over 2 years. The first 2 years that the school was open,
right?
And essentially, they were told they had to spend all the money.
Right.
Otherwise, it would look. I mean, then if they don't spend all the money, it looks like the person who's allocated the money has done the sums wrong.
Right.
And so they're on the phone to them saying, "You've got X amount still in your account. It has to be spent by such and such a date." Right. And I know when I was in charge of a particular department in a school, I was being hassled to spend all the money that I had. You couldn't like save some for the next year. It had to be spent by April.
Right.
And if it wasn't spent, you essentially the next year your budget would be cut
by that much,
just more than that.
All right.
And so it was in your interest to spend it.
So that actually seems like a fairly massive flaw with the infrastructure.
It's changed a bit.
Take care.
It's changed now because what the last government did, which you see, you don't tend to hear about this in the news, but they were cutting budgets before. And what they said was, you see, schools had huge reserves of money.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, in some cases, a couple of million in reserve. And it was just what was left at the end of a budgetary year for standard running costs of the school.
Yeah.
Say they hadn't spent as much in fuel. These were areas where they didn't have to spend anything. It was, they were given a set amount to spend on fuel, spend on books, spend on pencils and all that. Mm-hmm. And what they had left at the end of the year, they tended to store for, like, if the boiler blew up or something, they needed a big expenditure. But the last government started saying that schools were going to have to spend what was in their reserve. And so you tended to find that if, say, your budget was £3,000 and you had £1,000 in reserve, the council would give you £2,000 and say, use the £1,000 you've got saved.
That makes perfect sense. I can't believe your schools were allowed to be in reserve. Like, I would find that shocking.
But on the other hand, if your boiler blows up in the middle of winter and you've no heat,
and that costs more than what you've got in reserve and what you've got for your funding.
You struggle then to get the funding to actually pay for your boiler. I mean, I've been in classrooms where kids have coats on, and when they breathe out, you can see the air. But like, because it's that cold, literally that cold in schools.
Well,
also a school where, in the first few weeks, the kids had to use thick crayons to write in because they didn't have any pencils. It's like a third world sometimes.
What I find is that many stimulus packages, at least in Spain, and I think in the US it's being the same, they're not talking about the stimulus here, but it will have to arrive one day or the other. Mm. And lots of these stimulus packages are very oriented to creating employment, so very little goes into the materials and everything. Mm. And much more goes into employing people. And the problem with that is that no money goes into maintenance. So, and I watched the documentary that you sent yesterday. I just saw the email and I connected with that. And it shocked me completely, because that kind of documentary, you would only see it in Spain in very, very, very ultra far right news media. I wouldn't expect to see that on, because it was really critical. So
I still need to watch that.
Having the unions on such a scrutiny.
The best, if you want the best news reports in this country, Channel 4 News at 7 o'clock at night is by far and away the best news reporter. It's far more impartial than the BBC.
It's like very unprejudiced.
I always find myself less inclined to, I guess, believe news delivered from a commercially driven source. Because, you know, they've got their, you know, advertising sponsors' interests at stake, whereas somewhere like the BBC or somewhere that's like independent, individually driven, there isn't that side to it.
But don't they have such a public service remit, even if they are?
Sort of, but it's the same as like if you look at American media, like you've got Fox, which barely counts as like a news source anymore, and it's just really right wing fear mongering stuff. And what they're reporting, that yes, there's something that the people who follow it have an interest in and have concerns about, but they go beyond just reporting it, and they turn it into a political fear factory for the benefits of the people who are behind that organisation.
Yes, but anyways, no. The point I was trying to make is that the approach I do to this subject, it have like a bit of a cultural shift, because we have a general strike in Spain tomorrow, and I'm following the coverage. And everything that is said against the unions is seen like from the entrepreneurial organizations, from the right. So I was quite shocked by this, and also I have to assume all this and to digest all this in order to be able to cover such things, because for me it was a bit of a shock, but I have to catch up with the first part of
it. But that dispatch is
wondering
watching as well.
If we should sort of liaise with the other half of the table, I don't know.
Yes.
Guys, do you have a... I'm just wondering if you have projects or websites or blogs that you're kind of working on, I'm wondering if we should just remind each other of what everyone's name is. Or if, etc. What
yes.
do you think?
Right. Yeah. Yes, because I spoke about
that. I'd be curious to know what other people are doing. I don't know what I'm doing.
Some of us don't know.
Yeah. You don't know.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because yeah. you've got your wedding news.
I haven't spoken with Paul yet, so okay. I have to speak for him, because I'm not really sure if that covered the idea of community. I think it should be okay, but it depends how the website is created. I
mean, yeah.
If it, I don't know, just to be, you know, some promotion or stuff like this.
Yeah.
I want to be more, you know, to be filled with information.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was just going to say that I think the two things that strike me about weddings, just me personally as a single, unmarried, never been married guy, is that on one hand it's a very emotional thing because of the, you know, the significance of it in your life, and the other is that it's a very commercial thing for the costs involved
it
and
is
everything.
Commercial,
yeah.
Yeah.
So the sort of the news side, like Andy was saying on the email, would be things like people being pushed into marriages or that sort of thing.
I think just
me personally, I can't quite see much scope for news on it.
I'm not sure if it has to be filled with news.
Right.
That's what I'm not really sure, and is it supposed to be a news website or not?
No, I think not really, because you can't.
It's a new website, a news website. No, it's really, really.
No, but I can see it perfectly, because there are magazines for people who are going to get wed, and
yeah.
I see many news media doing these special supplements where they usually do them because they get lots of advertising that otherwise they wouldn't do, and I can find the more or less the because you would have the typical post with a post with tips, a post with I know that in the New York Times, for example, they have I think it's on Saturdays or Sundays, they have this big, I don't know how it's called now, it's a section devoted to weddings.
Hmm.
So they people propose
wedding announcements. They're very famous.
Yes. And they get to come, and they have these very strict rules that it has to be between the next day and the next 7 days, and they do very high quality journalism.
Bigger functionality of the website.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can use it like, I have some ideas. I can write them down if you're interested. I just that's the way that people are going to, you know, to bring them together in this website, not just to read about how to get married, because I guess everybody knows it. I mean, you know, just more interesting in information and different point of view, or something like this.
And about the form of all this, when you asked about Joomla and WordPress, Joomla, when we mentioned it the first day, you weren't here, we...
On the first Monday,
I mentioned, no? I'm thinking, I know more or less how to use WordPress, but maybe I would be interested in using Joomla, and we're here, Paul and Caroline Devon, from what he's
oh,
was from
last
year.
Joomla, right?
And no, when I mentioned Joomla, they said, it seems to be too much complicated.
And I said, what's Joomla?
Yeah.
It's just a platform. It's not so hard to. I don't know it perfect, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not a web developer, but it's a ready platform to use, like WordPress. It's just not so popular because Joomla is for websites and WordPress.
It's a content management system, isn't it?
Every platform has their content management system. Like WordPress, it has their own CMS, and Joomla has their own, you know. It's just a different. It's just like.
I mean, I've used Joomla before, and it was very much sort of all in one content management system.
Yeah,
like for WordPress, you would get like a cover that would be the content management system, a bit like vBulletin. You can buy get vBulletin Advanced, which is a content management system that just sits in front of the forum.
Yeah.
But from my experience, and it might have changed since I used it, but Joomla was like an all in one. You could say, I want a forum, I want blog posts, I want RSS feeds, and then it can just bang there. It's all there for
you. I find it more difficult to work with Joomla than with WordPress because they're bigger functionality.
I found it harder to, when using Joomla, I found it hard to personalise it as well. It seemed a lot more difficult to change the look and style, I found. Obviously, it's different for different people, but I soon ran out of patience with it and just did away with it.
Yeah.
And
WordPress is used more for blogs.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to set up a site that looks like blog, you should work WordPress.
Yes.
It's much better.
But going back to the editorial part, I can see, for example, I think of blog networks in Spain that have a blog on music or on motors or anything, and I think they have blogs about weather. Because it's something that you can, it's a bit seasonal too, but if you are covering a community, you can also cover the places where people get married and everything. And I find it very, very unfocused and everything, so I'm not very interested on the topic, so maybe I wouldn't work on this.
But so
No. No, but I find it a great community to serve. So,
Honestly, I have to speak with Paul if that's logical, because it's much different than, you know, this hyper-local stuff and politics and economics and cuts and
But
like
I find
this.
The point, so...
It's just different.
And it's something you can do on your own, because maybe the economic thing or if you're covering an area or something, maybe you have to do it in a group or you can do it very well. But maybe that if it's an individual project, maybe you're eager to having more people stepping up, no? Mm-hmm.
And, it depends how big you decide to make your website. Oh.
Okay, see you. Friday.
We don't have anything this Friday.
No session this Friday.
Okay. So they are just talking to me.
Do you have enterprise on Tuesday or on Thursday?
They don't have funding.
you don't have enterprise.
No.
Okay.
you guys are
talking
about
one week Friday.
Yes.
Then.
I in the program I think it says double class and we have on Thursday and Friday, but I would have to write to Paul to ask that, because there is one on the 7th and one on the 8th of October.
Where are you seeing? You're going to have to show me where you see that.
In the syllabus he linked. I actually have it here. So I think it's Thursday and Friday, and maybe.
So I have to go get coffee.
Okay, I was thinking...
You're not going anywhere, right? Can I leave my bag?
Yeah. Okay.
My computer and stuff?
No, I was thinking...
Bye-bye.
See you. Are we going to stay here, or are we going anywhere?
Well, we could go over to Urban Coffee and have a working internet connection.
I was thinking of that. I was going to Urban Coffee Company, and I should grab a bite, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, what do you think about that? Maybe to have Wi-Fi to be able to...
Are you not here?
No, it doesn't work.
No. Broadband?
No, there's a Wi-Fi connection.
Is this where we went before?
I thought it was the same.
Yes.
14-inch, so it's bigger.
This is a 17-inch.
Oh,
okay. Mine's 14-inch.
That way we can try Google Docs and Delicious and everything.
Yeah, I can see.
Because here it's useless.
Oh, it's...